This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is going to sound like a trick question, which, to be honest, it kind of is. How do you spell uncertainty in this economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 30th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It will perhaps not come as a surprise that one spells uncertainty in this economy late July 2018, not in the conventional way. Here at Marketplace and in much of corporate America, uncertainty starts with a T. It ends with Arifs, and it gets us to our lead story today, the betwixt and between nature of corporate profits at this moment. The industrial giant Caterpillar largely shrugged off the T word today. It raised its outlook for the year and reported a near doubling of quarterly profits, even as its materials costs, think steel and aluminum, might go up by as much as $200 million American dollars. Tyson Foods, meanwhile, the chicken and pork people, cut its forecast for the year, blaming T word induced uncertainty. Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going by laying out the current corporate landscape.
Tyson joins companies like Harley-Davidson, Whirlpool, GM, and Ford, warning investors of lower profits ahead thanks to tariffs. Tariffs can make their products more expensive to make and hurt sales.
There's always a worry du jour among CFOs who tend to be a nervous lot in terms of quarterly calls. I don't think it's that big of a macro issue at this point.
That's Barry Bannister, head of institutional equity strategy at Stifel. Caterpillar's executives seem to agree today, saying they'll absorb higher steel and aluminum costs by raising prices on construction equipment. Analyst Elizabeth Vermillion covers industrial stocks for CFRA.
Listening into a lot of other calls in the space, price increases are not uncommon, and so I think customers at this point are pretty expectant of that.
Recreational vehicle maker Polaris says it's also raising prices on boats and snowmobiles. Coca-Cola is charging more for a can of soda. The strong economy gives companies some wiggle room, says Beth Ann Bovino, U.S. Chief Economist at S&P Global Ratings.
And of course, we have that nice tax package that helps kind of cushion some of that blow from higher prices at the mall. So I think businesses can feel that they can pass on some of those component costs to the consumer and still not really dent the demand for their products.
But she says uncertainty over where the trade war is headed could weigh on future growth.
So that guidance that businesses give to investors is clouded. And that, I think, is one concern that everybody faces.
Whether corporate executives share their concerns publicly or not. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Scott Pruitt, the now departed head of the Environmental Protection Agency, spent about a year and a half in that job, during which he spent a lot of time undoing mostly Obama-era environmental regulations. The new guy, acting administrator Andrew Wheeler, has been on the job for a couple of 3 weeks now. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Washington on whether the Wheeler EPA might do things a little bit differently.
Under Scott Pruitt, the EPA allowed unlimited production of certain commercial trucks that the agency found particularly polluting. In a court fight, his successor, Andrew Wheeler, undid the move, saying it fell outside the bounds of agency discretion. Myron Ebel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute led the Trump EPA transition team.
I think he's going to cut his losses and say, this just isn't worth the effort and we're likely to lose in court, and so we're going to not worry about it and move on to bigger things.
which in Ebell's view means reversing President Obama's, quote, regulatory onslaught. Wheeler's truck decision is just a tactical retreat, says administration critic Stephen Silverman. He's a retired EPA attorney.
He was willing to see that he had no legal case on this particular matter. But in terms of protecting the public, I don't see anything that would indicate a proper approach, which would be to take the health of the public as the prime consideration here.
That was a common criticism of Pruitt, too. Wheeler is also reportedly cautious on a pending rule to roll back auto mileage and emissions rules because of fears that it may not survive court challenge either. Unlike Pruitt, Wheeler is a D.C. veteran who's worked at the EPA, in Congress, and as a corporate lobbyist. Retired EPA official Janet McCabe teaches at Indiana University's School of Law.
Having a background in these different areas is helpful, I think, but I hope that he is listening to those people now.
We reached out to the EPA today and got no response. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
When things are uncertain, companies often find safety in size. To be fair, safety is found in size even when everything's fine in businesses. But the through line here is that bigger for those businesses is usually better. Today, food. U.S. Foods, already among the biggest food service distributors in this country, is buying five business groups from Service Group of America. That's a $2 billion cash deal as the company pushes west across this country. Marketplace's Erica Barris explains what it might mean for your dinner.
If you've ever had an entree in a hospital cafeteria or a snack at a stadium, chances are the food you're eating comes from an enormous food distribution company. Even though we want options when we eat, anyone running a kitchen doesn't really want to source our wings and celery from different places. So says Jonathan Doe, business professor at Villanova University.
It's just not efficient to have five different suppliers for your, you know, frozen French fried potatoes.
We've seen lots of food supplier consolidations. Kraft and Heinz, Conagra and Pinnacle. Don Thilmany, an agribusiness economist at Colorado State University, says this acquisition is different. Because U.S. Foods is a distributor. They prepare and deliver food. They don't produce it. And she says all of these companies are responding to market pressures.
Fairly even negotiating and playing field exists across the whole food supply chain.
The acquisition expands U.S. Foods' reach into the Southwest and Northwest. Dipanjan Chatterjee, an analyst with Forrester Research, says if a company wants to move into a new market, rather than starting from scratch, it makes sense to just
acquire an existing operation that already has the infrastructure, the customer relationships.
And he says legacy companies don't want to spend time and money trying things out. They'd rather have small startups do it. Then, if it seems profitable, acquire them. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down, down, and more down went the three major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can pretty much tick off on your fingers the slices of this economy in which the after effects of the financial crisis, lo, these 10 years gone by, are still playing out. Banking and finance, obviously. Real estate. The politics of the economy, for sure. Also, academia, the teaching of economics. Groups of economic students want to know more about what happened and why. The best-known group was formed 6 years ago at the University of Manchester over in the UK. It's called the Post-Crash Economics Society. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has their story.
When he came to choose what to study at university, Cathal Moran says the decision was a no-brainer. The year was 2011, not long after the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
I wanted to try and make sense of this big issue, the financial crisis, which nobody really seemed to have foreseen, nobody really seemed to understand at the time.
But after his first year of economics at Manchester University, Moran was bitterly disappointed.
Something like the financial crisis wasn't even mentioned.
A deplorable omission, says one of his fellow students at the time, Maeve Cohen.
I find it completely inexcusable that the global financial crisis, 4 years after it happened, wasn't mentioned in the core economics module. It was absolutely unforgivable, in my opinion.
Cohen and Moran and another student, Joe Earle, formed the Post-Crash Economics Society. They felt their subject had become detached from reality. They thought it was over-dependent on mathematical models, ignoring actual human behaviour. The society's aim, says Earle, to press for fundamental changes to the Manchester curriculum.
We called for more real-world focus. We called for more critical thinking. We called for more kind of history.
Economic history, they argued, had been sidelined, not just in Manchester, but throughout the economics profession. Cahill Moran says the crisis might even have been averted had more people been better versed in the repeated crashes down the centuries.
The South Sea bubble, the Mississippi bubble, Tulip Mania, Great Depression, the Long Depression, you know, the East Asian financial crisis. And even a cursory knowledge of those would have helped policymakers just to be on their guard and to know how to react.
6 years on from the birth of the post-crash economic society, much has improved at Manchester, says Moran, who's now a PhD student at the university.
There's quite a few new modules. There's one on economic history. There's one on economics of public policy, which is very practical. And there's more modules coming as well, which is really great.
And the movement to bring more daylight and more reality into the study of economics has, says Joe Earle, spread well beyond Manchester.
Today, there are over 50 groups in 23 countries around the world that completely independently started campaigning.
That campaign will continue, he says, until the post-crash movement achieves its ultimate goal, persuading all economics teachers that
economics isn't a science with one right answer. It is about ethics and it is about politics. You can't just have experts putting numbers into a calculator and churning out the right answer.
And that is perhaps the most resounding lesson of the crash. Economists do get things wrong, and sometimes spectacularly. In Manchester, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Picking up where Stephen's piece left off, the lessons of the crash that we're still learning, we're going to do another installment of our series on what the financial crisis did to this economy and the people living in it. It's called How We Changed. Today, Spencer Newell, fresh out of college in the early 2000s, living and working in Bend, Oregon, but watching very closely what his friends were doing.
In 2006, I had real estate buddies of mine making in 1 month as much as I would make in a year. And so for fear of missing out on the incredible market, I dove headfirst into real estate. I describe it as a time of funny money. And in Bend, everything was just escalating so much in terms of home values. And for me, once I got into the fast game of making money, like I had to fuel it and I had to keep it going. I used alcohol and drugs to work even harder. I had some pretty bad habits. We were told it just wasn't going to end. And, you know, I leveraged myself to the hilt. I took all of the money and all the equity out of my house, knowing and assuming that it would never stop. 2008 hit. It was a pretty humbling time. I was among the many in during that time where I gave my keys back to the bank and just surrendered to the foreclosure market. I maintained the alcoholic and the addictive tendencies, and I actually went through an episode where it was suicidal tendencies and had to check myself into a psychiatric hospital. I dug such a deep hole for myself spiritually, emotionally, financially. You know, I kind of threw my hands up and surrendered. That was the bottom, I would say, for me. I think that situation caused my addictions to accelerate. And I'm really glad that they did, because who knows where I would be now. You know, I got sober when I was 34. And since I was a little kid, I always had this dream of becoming an elite athlete. You know, I was a cyclist and an ultra runner in my 20s, but the thing that got in my way was drugs and alcohol. So now, like, I know I'm 38, but it's the first time I'm able to really step back and start, you know, making a push at it. I have not been as happy as I am right now in a long, long time, probably even before the downturn. And so I look at it now 10 years later, and in an odd way, I'm pretty thankful it happened.
Spencer Newell is making a go of it at 38. He's a professional endurance athlete. He started a wellness company, and he's written about his experiences. It's a book called Appetite for Addiction. We've got a picture or two of Spencer on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM there. And share your story with us while you're there if you feel like it. The hashtag we're using is HowWeChanged. Coming up,
there weren't necessarily fine lines between what was their office and what was just a part of the community.
Real estate in Venice, California. Oh, snap. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 144 today, 0.5%, 25,306. The NASDAQ down 107. That's about 1.3%, 7630. The S&P 500 dipped 16 points, about 0.5%. 0.5% is another way to say that, 2802. Another schlumpy day in tech stocks. Twitter dropped another 8% today after a big loss on Friday. Facebook down 2%. Amazon off 2%. Netflix down 5.7%. Google parent Alphabet 1.8%. All to the negative there. AMD a bright spot in tech. The chipmaker advanced 2.5%. The world's number two beer maker failed to meet investor expectations in its quarterly earnings report. And so Heineken down 5% in overseas trading. The top dog brewer Anheuser-Busch InBev down 1%. Although, editorial comment here, neither of those companies actually make decent beer. You're listening to Marketplace. Anne in Stamford, Connecticut wrote to say that Marketplace and Make Me Smart help her contextualize so much of what is happening in the world right now in a way that is approachable and entertaining. Anne, thanks for being a friend to Marketplace and for supporting our work. To join her as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You saw the GDP numbers Friday, right? Gross domestic product. The economy grew at a quite nice but not likely to be sustainable 4.1% last quarter. A chunk of that was you and me, consumers, and us spending more. Thing is, how we're spending is changing, which is having some trickle-down effects, if you will. We've gotten Alana Furco on the line once again to get a sense of what it's like out there in the brick-and-mortar retail economy. She manages the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. Alana, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, happy to visit with you today, Kai.
So look, one of the reasons, well, really the reason we're talking to you is because we were sitting around the other day talking about retail in this economy and how consumers do seem to be buying things. And somebody said, you know, we ought to call Alana in Butte and get it from the mall sort of supply side of the retail equation. So the question really to start with is, how's retail doing at the Butte Plaza Mall?
Well, you know, every day is a fresh opportunity for creative problem solving.
Oh, man. So that either things are great or not so good. I can't tell.
Well, you know, it is what it is. Right now, our Herberger's, which is a Bon Ton property, is in active liquidation.
Wow.
The store will be closed by the end of August.
So wait, I should know this, but what is Herberger sell? Are they like a big box clothing? Do they do, what do they do?
Department store.
So that's a biggie.
That's a biggie. It's my north anchor.
Well, but we talked to you a number of years ago, and you just lost the other anchor, JCPenney, right?
We did, yes.
This is going to sound stupid. Are you anchorless in a shopping mall? You have no anchor stores.
Well, we still have a Sixplex Theater, and I still have Joann Fabrics and Crafts.
All right, so this is going to sound grim, but when folks come on a Friday night for a movie, what's the scene? Are there people bustling around the mall, or is it empty-ish?
Well, you know, right now that's actually, we've got tourist season.
Aha.
So, you know, we've had some really nice tourist visits. We also have opened an awesome business. Have you heard of Escapology or Escape Rooms?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I did one once. We did not escape, but that's a whole different thing.
Right across from my theater, we have a 5-room Escapology. It's doing extremely well. Huh. My food is still doing very well. And I'll tell you that the retail we have, people are still shopping. I mean, you know, when you don't have much, what you have is a big fish in a little pond.
Yeah, I hear you. What are you doing with all the empty space from the JCPenney and the Herberger's?
Well, the JCPenney right now, we have a local hotel that's remodeling, so they are warehousing the new furniture in there. It's definitely outside the box thinking. There isn't even a box anymore. I mean, it's 3D chess, and all the pieces are the same color.
When When folks want stuff that they used to get at Herberger's or JCPenney, do they have to leave town and go to like Missoula or wherever?
They do leave town, but our arch emesis as well is online shopping.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's just as easy to order it from your phone to your mailbox.
Last thing, Elena, and then I'll let you go. What about the jobs that used to come along with these big anchor stores? Are folks feeling that there in Butte?
You know, we've got almost 60 people at Herberger's, and getting them through this is our main focus. And it's hard. The loss of every store is, it's like we're suffering a death because there's not a lot of stand-up retail. We have a Walmart. Our Kmart closed in June. So, yeah, stand-up retail really is becoming tough placement.
Elena Furco helps run things at the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. Elena, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Take care, Kai.
I'm going to riff on that old real estate truism, location, 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 as a way to get us into this next piece, with this observation that it is possible for a company to have too many locations. Snap, of Snapchat fame, is our example today. Founded in 2011 in Venice, California, out by the beach near Los Angeles, Snap at one point had dozens of properties in Venice that it was using. But just like its disappearing messaging function, Snap has been disappearing from the Venice real estate market as it tries to cut costs. Not, though, as Benjamin Gottlieb reports now from KCRW, without leaving a changed local real estate market behind.
When you visit Venice and spend some time on the boardwalk, there are some things that just don't change. You've got vendors selling tchotchkes, antiques, clothing, paintings, surfers, tourists, and LA's homelessness problem out in plain view for all to see. But something feels a little bit different these days, and some residents blame that on Snap.
Their general presence has raised the rents and property values so much that a lot of people can't afford it.
Andy Rovins has lived in Venice for more than 40 years. I meet him at a Venice boardwalk landmark, the Gingerbread Court. It stands out on the beach, a cute little red brick pedestrian mall that surrounds a courtyard. According to the real estate data tracker CoStar, this is one of the buildings that Snap leased a few years ago. But now?
You see anybody here? I mean, it's like, that's empty, that's empty, that's empty.
David Freitag works in tenant relations for the real estate firm CBRE in Los Angeles.
We've kind of walked around and seen where Snap's footprint is.
He says that at its peak, Snap leased more than 300,000 square feet of office space in and around Venice to accommodate its workforce of more than 3,000 employees.
And I think there weren't necessarily fine lines between what was their office and what was just a part of the community.
Snap's had a bumpy ride since it went from scrappy startup to publicly traded behemoth last year. The company has struggled to compete with the likes of Facebook and Google for ad revenue. And earlier this year, it laid off 10% of its engineers. Now it's consolidating operations at an office park in neighboring Santa Monica. In a statement, a spokesperson for Snap said, quote, "We are looking forward to bringing teams closer together in Santa Monica." Still, during the transition, examples of Snap's footprint in Venice remain.
This building really sticks out here in Venice. This is no more than a couple hundred feet from the boardwalk. There's no signage, but you can see employees swiping Snap badges and walking inside. They've got laptops, smartphones in their hand. There's also a security guard outside, which is a dead giveaway. I asked one guard why it's so secretive here, and he told me that's just how they want it.
Even as it leaves, the changes Snap brought here aren't all so quickly erased. Michael Springer is a commercial real estate agent in Venice. He's not anti-development, he says, but the community has lost things.
They absorbed so much of the real estate very quickly. And as they did, certain places that were public, like Nikki Beach, which was a really great restaurant and bar, they took those things away
and turned them into space for its employees. Springer says Snap also remade the real estate market in Venice. If you look at prices, back in July of 2013, the median rent sat at just over $3,500. That's according to the real estate database Zillow. Fast forward to today, the median price is almost $2,000 more. Springer and his firm Halton Party and Partners hope that as Snap leaves, more tech startups will move in. He's showing several properties in and around Venice.
Snap took up all of the inventory, and as they did, they were offering higher and higher rents. That's basically made this market.
Office space that used to go for $3 or $4 per square foot is now more like $5 or $6. One location that Snap occupied is $13 a square foot. But Mark Wanamaker of the Venice Historical Society says change like this is inevitable.
It's true, though, that when you bring in a lot of people and businesses like this, the prices go up. But the modern world, the reality of it, is that you can't keep it a sleepy community.
And as rents continue to rise in Venice, Silicon Beach is spilling over into other parts of L.A., where things are still cheaper for now. In Los Angeles, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a statement from the CBS Board of Directors this afternoon about the sexual misconduct allegations against CEO Les Moonves, although the board did not mention it by name. Here's what they said, quote, CBS Corporation announced today that its board of directors is in the process of selecting outside counsel to conduct an independent investigation. No other action was taken on this matter at today's board meeting, end of quote. The thing they did take action on, though, was to postpone the company's annual meeting, which had been set for August the 10th, at which the power play between Moonves and Sherry Redstone, daughter of the controlling shareholder of CBS and Viacom, Sumner Redstone, was almost certainly going to come up. All right, that's all we got. Dow Industrials off 144 today, about a half percent. NASDAQ down 107, 1.3%. The S&P 500 off 16 points. That's about a half percent. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects team includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.